Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Ready to Pop, the ultimate pregnancy podcast series with me, author and journalist Caroline Foran. So if you tuned into the quick intro episode I did, you'll have a very clear idea of what to expect from this series and from each episode. But just to recap briefly, I myself am currently pregnant. I'm at the time of this recording very much almost through my third trimester, almost ready to pop. And this 8-part series takes you from getting pregnant right through to preparing for labour and beyond. So for this episode, I am joined by Dr. Maeve Horan, who is with the Marian Fertility Clinic, to talk about the very first steps of your pregnancy journey. And that, of course, is getting pregnant. So what has to happen to get pregnant? What are the common issues that make pregnancy difficult to achieve? What are the treatment options if you do have difficulties? How can we increase our chances of conception naturally? And what do we need to be mindful of in our lifestyle? This episode is proudly sponsored by Mars Pharmacy, the pharmacy that I go to myself not just for all of my health and beauty needs, but for expert advice that I can really trust. Mars Pharmacy offers private and secure video calls with their fertility expert for those hoping to conceive. And for an appointment, just simply email help@marspharmacy.ie. It's M-E-A-G-H-E-R-S, pharmacy.ie. And their pharmacists are always available for private consultations about your medicines, administering injections, as well as supplements that might help as you begin your journey towards parenthood. For more information on Mars Pharmacy as well as your nearest branch, go to marspharmacy.ie or follow them on Instagram @marspharmacy. Also, be sure to follow me on Instagram @CarolineForan, where I will be giving one lucky listener a fabulous Mars Pharmacy hamper packed full of goodies to celebrate this first episode. Now, let's get down to business with Dr. Maeve Horan. Dr. Maeve Horan, thank you so much for joining me on Ready to Pop. I'm so delighted to have you for my very first episode as part of this 8-part series. And originally, I wanted to do a series that focused primarily on pregnancy, but how could I do that without really focusing on getting pregnant in the first place? And for so many women, you know, it's not a straight journey of just having sex and becoming pregnant. There's lots of different routes towards conception. So I really wanted to have a chat with someone such as yourself to talk about, you know, what to expect when trying to get pregnant, what's normal, what to be mindful of. So thank you so much for giving me your time and your expertise.
No, it's great. I guess it's something very close to my heart since I've gone into fertility. I've been doing obstetrics and gynecology for almost 7 years now, and I've slightly segued into kind of specializing in fertility in the past year. And I think that's opened my eyes to, as you say, just simple things you can do before you go down the line of treatment or that kind of journey at all. So
absolutely. And you're with the Marian Fertility Clinic, is that right?
Yeah, I've been there for a year now, really enjoying it. Yeah, and exactly, that's how I kind of piqued my interest in this area. Yeah.
And what would your typical week be like? How does your job work? I mean, would you be having consultations back to back, or would you be actually doing treatments with people?
So yeah, it's different every day, which again is a huge interesting part of the job. So basically, it has changed a little bit since COVID, but actually some of the changes are, like, I think everyone's discovering, for the better. So now we are doing quite a few Zoom consultations, which I think makes it more accessible for either women on their own or couples to approach us together, because, you know, people we're often working apart, so that's easier. And people coming who aren't in Dublin, I mean, we're based in Marion Square, so that's not often the easiest place to get parking and all those very simple practicalities. So we're doing Zoom. So I do 1 to 2 days a week of consultations with couples. And then other days during the week, we're doing different parts of the treatment cycle. So egg collections for women who are going through IVF, sometimes surgeries for women who are, kind of pre-treatment or with underlying conditions, and scanning and different things like that other days.
Okay, wow. So every day is different for you. But before we get on to talking about the problems that can arise or where fertility might become an issue, I'd love to just give listeners an overview of getting pregnant in general, because I think we spend, you know, as women, so much of our lives trying not to get pregnant that when it actually comes to it, for me anyway, I was like, I actually don't know a whole lot about what has to happen in my body and all the different things involved. So we might just start with, I mean, literally the birds and bees, if that's okay.
Absolutely. No, and that's such a huge part of it, and a huge part of couples trying to kind of align things so that they're in a good situation. So, yeah, and as you say, loads of us try for so long not to get pregnant. So we're on different types of contraceptives. We haven't had a natural cycle or a natural period for years. We've never observed kind of signs of ovulation or looked out for them even. So first of all, your own natural cycle. So I kind of say most cycles that vary between 24 to 35 days. And obviously there is, you know, some of these are a little bit arbitrary, are usually ovulatory cycles. So cycles that are really irregular, so more than 6 weeks apart or only having a few cycles a year, is something to look out for down the line in terms of fertility. Because what we're looking for is that you're releasing an egg kind of monthly and that's happening reasonably regularly. So that's the first thing. If you have an underlying medical condition that you've been attending a doctor for as well, or you're on medications for, it's always good to check in before you stop your contraception to see whether the medications that you're on are appropriate to conceive, for, you know, and that it's safe to stop them. So women who are maybe on antiepileptics or diabetics, to make sure that they're kind of optimizing their own medical health before they
go trying everything, you know, to start off with the knowledge that you want to try. So let's start from the best position possible.
Exactly.
If we take, for example, a woman and a male partner who have no fertility issues, and can we just talk through what exactly happens in the getting pregnant process? I know they obviously have sex, but ovulation and all those different, I mean, I never knew anything about luteal phases and basal body temperature, but what's happening behind the scenes when conception happens?
Yeah, so there's two phases of a menstrual cycle. So day one is the first day that you bleed. So that's how we count our, you know, the length of a cycle. So your day one is the first day that your period starts. And then kind of cycles vary. And like what we use in textbooks would probably be your kind of 28 to 30 day cycle. And so the luteal phase tends to be the second half of the cycle. And that typically is around 14 days in length. So we say that is after you ovulate. So if you have a 28-day cycle, for example, you might ovulate mid-cycle there around day 14. Again, varies a little bit for every different woman. And we tell them to look out for signs like, you know, you might get some cramping on either the left or the right, or a change in the cervical mucus. So it kind of becomes described as like an egg-white consistency or stretchy. And some people don't get any of those signs, which is okay as well. And other people track their temperature, like you said. So they see a spike in their temperature around that time. And at that point, we say, you know, you've probably ovulated, but it's the fertile window is actually the lead up to that. So it's having sex the 5 days before you ovulate and the day that you ovulate. And why that is because, you know, the egg is released and lasts for around kind of 12 to 24 hours, but it takes the sperm 2 days to get to where it should get. So it's the lead up that's actually the important part. So those 5 days before, so the sperm can survive that long kind of in the womb, cervix, tubes, but the egg doesn't survive as long as the sperm will.
Okay, so assuming all goes well, sperm meets egg, and then what happens?
So fertilization takes place, and that takes around 24 hours, and it's in the tube until around day 3, and then moves down towards the womb at around day 5 onwards, and then implantation starts. So that's where the blastocyst or the embryo will implant into the lining of the womb. So it's a few days before it's in the womb, and then you probably see a change in the hormone that might show up on a very early pregnancy test from around kind of day 10 to 16 or 2 weeks after that.
Okay. And even in women where there or men where there's no problem, no fertility issue, it's still really almost like the stars have to align for that sperm to meet that egg and fertilize at the right time. Isn't that right? Because I think a lot of people, I suppose, would think that when, if it's not happened, that immediately a problem, but people can maybe not conceive for 6 months, and it doesn't mean there's actually a problem. It's just a bit of luck and timing.
Exactly. The worst stories are the ones where they just stop contraception and they get pregnant the next cycle, because, you know, that is, as you say, the unusual ones, you know. So we would say kind of in women under the age of 35 who have no underlying conditions, as we were saying, you know, they're not aware of such as endometriosis, or they've never had an ectopic pregnancy before, or they haven't had a ruptured appendix surgery or anything like that, they can try for up to a year. And we say In the general population, around 80% of couples will conceive within a year, and then in 2 years, up to 90% of couples will conceive.
Wow, and that's with no intervention at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and no risk factors, I guess, for fertility issues. Yeah,
and we'll get on to talking about when the time comes to consult medical advice. But just while we're still in the kind of very basic birds and bees stuff, you mentioned there that the egg gets fertilized in the fallopian tube, and if that doesn't move down to the uterus, then that's called an ectopic pregnancy.
An ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy that's implanted anywhere outside where it should. So the most common place for it is the tube, but sometimes we see it in more unusual places, such as the ovary or even in the cervix, or someone who's had a previous cesarean section in the scar. But certainly the most common place where we'd see it is in the tube. Yeah, and it's never going to move position once it's implanted there. So unfortunately, that pregnancy is not viable if it's implanted in the tube. And it's not that uncommon. It's probably around 11 in 1,000, or almost 1% of pregnancies. So we do see it frequently enough, and it can be a very serious condition.
It's something you definitely don't hear that much about.
Yeah, no. And oftentimes, you get a positive pregnancy test and it feels like early pregnancy, and maybe it's picked up on an early scan, or maybe you have a bit of pain or spotting an early pregnancy, and all of these things are actual parts of early pregnancy as well. So the diagnosis can be drawn out at times, especially if it's low hormone levels, and it can be really difficult. And sometimes women obviously end up needing either medical treatment, which they can't get pregnant for a number of months after, or surgery, which involves probably most likely removing one of the tubes, you know?
Wow. Okay. And a friend of mine said the other day, she's doing a lot of research into fertility, that if you have to get one tube removed, say, for example, because of an ectopic pregnancy, you could tell me if this is true or not, but she had read something that said, if, you know, the way the ovaries alternate releasing the egg, that if it's the other side where you don't have a tube, the tube on the other side will actually like eventually move around and attach itself. Like
it can. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And that is always, you know, because obviously removing both your tubes precludes you from getting pregnant, you know, yourself. So it is a big thing when counselling women about removing the tubes, that it's not the end of natural pregnancy. We certainly see pregnancies again after that. And, your fertility isn't reduced just with removing one tube.
So you said like about 5 days between fertilization and the egg actually implanting into the uterus in a healthy pregnancy. And at that point, I mean, you're definitely not feeling anything, but what's happening hormonally and what happens between that point and when you get like a pregnancy positive pregnancy test?
So the follicle that has released that egg becomes what's called the corpus luteum. So if we were to scan you, you might see this kind of a cyst appearing on one side, and that produces a hormone that will support the pregnancy until the pregnancy is big enough that it will support itself and produce its own pregnancy hormone called HCG. So progesterone is rising, estrogen is rising. So sometimes people can feel symptomatic very early in pregnancy because they're sensitive to those hormones. And then the pregnancy is doubling in size all the time, so the cells are doubling. So it's rapid growth very early, but as you say, we're talking about something really, really tiny and microscopic almost at the start. But there's some signs of it that you can see, the thickening of the lining of the womb, that cyst on one side. And then eventually, within kind of the 2 weeks mark, a urine pregnancy test should show up as positive.
And are there other common symptoms that would indicate pregnancy before you've done a test that are very common, like sore boobs, for example, is what I had?
No, nausea and vomiting can be quite early symptoms as well. And if we say that they're very severe, very early, you can kind of, you'd always scan to see if it's a twin pregnancy or something. Because women get very symptomatic, because obviously there's double the amount of hormone there, you know.
I was convinced I was having twins because of how hungry I was and how sick I felt, but it was just the one, and now I think I could not do it if it was twins. Oh my God. Okay, so then at that point, I'm just kind of going through the timeline of it. When you do a pregnancy test and it's confirmed, and for most women it's when they've missed a period, it's a little bit confusing because it shows up that you're 4 weeks pregnant. That's how they time it. Why does it go back to the first date of your last period?
So I guess you're trying to work out when you've ovulated, and that's because the fertilization isn't exactly on a day, because you could have ovulated and then when is the sperm reaching the ovulation. So it's just trying to to calculate the pregnancy most accurately from the previous ovulation, I guess.
And then on the pregnancy test, it's detecting the surge in the LH, is that right?
With the HCG, actually.
HCG,
that
okay.
Be the ovulation kits, but HCG is the pregnancy hormone.
Okay, so if someone is planning on having a baby and wants to, you know, wants to make sure that, they go in with you know, all systems blazing and they're aware of things, would it be very common? I did myself use ovulation sticks to kind of track, because it's very hard to know, especially if you say like, okay, when you can know when you've ovulated, and I would know, I think, in terms of like discharge, but like you say, it's before that is when you need to start having sex. So how do those ovulation sticks work, and do you recommend them?
So I think the first thing to say is that if you have a reasonably regular cycle and you get the signs and you know your own body, that's probably the best way. That's probably the best way. But again, so you just, why the ovulation kits can be helpful is to kind of identify those signs for you. You know, like you see a positive and you're like, actually, yeah, I did have pain that cycle. Or I did notice the change in my discharge. I think they can be a little bit stressful. You know, it's not particularly pleasant to be peeing on a stick and then going off and having sex under pressure, do you know? So it's like suddenly it's kind of taking the romance out of it a little bit.
Absolutely.
You know, it's timed sex is under pressure. A lot of time men find that a bit stressful as well, and their performance can be affected. So I certainly think they're useful if you show up a positive and if you can work them. There's different kits show different things, you know, say peak ovulation or a smiley face. So we in the clinic, if we're using them to time treatments, we start testing from around day 9 onwards. I don't know what you did, Caroline. Did you?
I just kind of went from, I guess, a couple of days before I thought I was ovulating, and then it did tee up pretty well. But I have friends who would have really felt like they were ovulating, but the test is showing that it's happening actually much later. So, and for them, they wanted to track it to know, well, actually what you think is what you kind of feel instinctively mightn't always line up.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you are trying to, like you say, time it, or so that can be frustrating for them as well. But I guess if we use it sometimes just to, yeah, like increase awareness of one's own body changes. And if then it is teeing up, then you can use it more appropriately. They should show up as, you know, ovulation or pre-ovulation LH surge, and then you're going to ovulate. That's what it should pick up. So you should know to have sex around then, I guess.
And if you don't want to worry about ovulation, or you're not there yet, you don't want to kind of start, like you say, putting that pressure on where you feel like, oh well, I'm ovulating, we have to jump in the sack now, and actually that just kills the romance. My doctor, my GP, when I told her I was maybe considering starting trying for baby, she just said to have sex 3 times a week every week, well, when you're not on your period, and you should be covered. Like, would you think that's a...
I actually say that as well. I think 3 times in the week leading up to when you ovulate, or so the first half of your cycle, so when your period finishes, up until, you know, just after mid-cycle, that should, you know, you should get it then, you know, you should hit the window, especially in couples who are having unprotected sex for quite a while. Do you know, like you were saying earlier about, you know, you're not going to get pregnant every cycle, even most normal of normals. So if you're doing that and, you know, and you've no risk factors and it's up to, you know, up to a year, you should hit ovulation at least 50% of those cycles, you know, you'd like to think.
Yeah, and I'd love to as well ask you about this, because I want to reassure women, and I'm sure it's very common, and certainly among my own friends, that, you know, the minute you shift your mentality from trying not to get pregnant to trying to get pregnant, it can very quickly take away the romance. And even for some people, the idea of having to have sex 3 times a week, and then you feel kind of bad, that, like, oh Jesus, like, is there something wrong with my relationship, that seems like a lot. But that is a lot of sex to be having, and if you're tired and you've got other kids already, or you're both working, you know, it's, I think I really want people to feel reassured that it's okay to kind of think that way as well. Although
you're so right, jobs get in the way, life gets in the way, if there's small kids already at home, you know, like all those things, absolutely, you know, it's you know, we probably find a lot of couples who have sex only that week and then no sex for the rest of the cycle because that's recreational and they've no time for that.
Exactly. I mean, I certainly had times where I knew I wasn't ovulating and I was like, oh, there's no point. Like, and it's just that it, you know, it does require energy. And when you think about your other primary needs, I suppose, in terms of hunger or sleepiness, you're like, well, I've taken care of that. So like, I mean, it is normal and it doesn't have to mean that there's, you know, something wrong. It's just like, of course it's pressure, you know, when you decide that you want to actively pursue something. And I think, you know, our generation or anybody, we're so used to, especially in this day and age, when you want something that you can have it right away and you can achieve it, and you might be a bit of an overachiever or a perfectionist, and something like this where Mother Nature takes over and you don't have as much control, it can be very hard to reconcile that you have to just sort of roll with it.
Exactly. And we do often see our men coming in, you know, who say they have absolutely no issue with sex. It's just the on-demand nature of trying to conceive and the urinary kit testing for the women. And it's just, it becomes almost medicalized, you know, and that is difficult because obviously it's not, you know, you're trying to do something that's meant to be giving you the most happiness.
I know. Like, full disclosure, like, because I was doing the ovulation test, but I kind of sort of kept it slightly, my husband obviously knew we were like open to it because we wanted to have, we had that conversation beforehand, but I tried to kind of, I guess for him, although I don't know why I was doing this for him, what about me? But I would kind of like, instead of saying, right, I'm ovulating, let's go now, I would try and like not make that be the starting point of the conversation, but try and initiate it so that, because I think, you know, with men, like you say, performance is a big issue. And if something gets in their head, it might not happen. And, you know, it's easier for women that you don't really have to be like on form to be able to conceive.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm looking back to that episode of Friends where Monica and Chandler are trying, you know, and it's like, suddenly it's, we have to go and have sex now, I'm ovulating. It's hard, you know.
Yeah, it is really hard. So can I ask you about the most fertile window in terms of age for men and women?
Yeah, so this is, I guess, as we age, this becomes something more significant in our lives, even myself, you know. So as women, we're born with the number of eggs that we'll have. It's a finite amount. So it probably peaks just, you know, in utero even, and then starts to decline probably most significantly after the age of 35, which seems really young. And I think it starts to seem younger the closer you get to it, do you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So even you could be the most healthy. That's one of the things we can't change in fertility is female age. And it's probably the best, I guess, surrogate marker for the egg quality as well, because these eggs are aging with us as we age. Whereas with men, they produce an entirely new sample of sperm every 3 months. So of course they'll get to a point where fertility is an issue, but it is, you know, those lifestyle factors are much more of an impact on male factor things, because they can change certain lifestyle factors where it's either it's smoking or using a laptop or using cannabis or steroids in the gym, those kind of factors. If they can adjust those, the new sample of sperm that they will produce might have improved drastically. Whereas with us, it's, you know, it's the eggs that we've had since we were born, so they are inevitably going to age with us, and we do see that decline after the age of 35.
And would be women beyond the age of 35 who you would most see in the clinic?
Yeah, and I think probably yeah, no, that it is most certainly. Obviously, if you've risk factors, you see women at different ages, but women, you know, like internationally and across the board, are delaying pregnancy for social reasons, for career, for relationship reasons. So certainly we are seeing women coming to us older and older.
And what would be the risk factors that you would see someone younger, say maybe 30 years old? What would that be, like the likes of PCOS or endometriosis? Or
yeah, so oftentimes, say for example, you mentioned PCOS there, so that is probably the most common hormonal condition in women, and it tends to present with either kind of irregular periods or no periods at all, or women who have maybe acne, they're investigated for acne or for dark hair growth. So often women would have an idea of that diagnosis before they even get to the stage where they're trying for pregnancy. And one of the other symptoms of it is it is not ovulating or having difficulties conceiving. So women who know that tend to come to us, and the referral might say, diagnosed with PCOS age 19 or 20 and have been on the pill for that, you know. So those women tend to have an idea that they might down the line have issues conceiving or need a little bit of help.
And is that a case of needing a little bit of help? Or, you know, I think a lot of women, certainly my peer group, you know, having been diagnosed with PCOS, they would think, oh shit, like this is the sentencing here. But is it? I mean, I remember speaking to someone else before for another project who said, actually, PCOS, you know, it's very possible to get pregnant with PCOS.
Yeah. So the thing with PCOS is that you tend to have lots and lots of eggs. It's just that you're not releasing them. So you're not ovulating. So we can overcome that. That's probably the most straightforward thing to overcome in terms of bringing about ovulation. It's not an invasive treatment. We start with an oral medication and we just monitor them with ultrasounds to make sure that they're firstly releasing at least one follicle and not releasing, or at least one follicle is growing and not too many are growing, because obviously one of the risks of these medications is the risk of multiple pregnancy when we bring about ovulation. So yeah, it is something that we can overcome. Probably start with the oral medications, that obviously makes it a lot less invasive. Yeah. But sometimes we need to use it in injections. But yeah, it is. It's one of those better ones, if for want of a better word.
And to go back to a scenario where declining egg supply and age is the issue, what would be the treatment there?
So I guess the treatment would probably be having a discussion about prioritizing fertility, you know. Yeah. So if it's just an investigation that you're having done to find out, then it's what would you do with that information? Do you know, the kind of same with everything. So are you in a relationship and planning on going traveling and you just wanted to find out that it was a reasonable thing to put on hold? Or are you thinking of taking a new job and you won't get maternity leave? You know, those kind of, if that's the case and you're just investigating to get an idea of your egg numbers or ovarian reserve, then you kind of have to be prepared to kind of know what you'll do with that result. Do you know? Yeah. Or whether you're on your own and you're 37 or 38 and you're you haven't met Mr. Right, or you're thinking about doing it on your own, would you consider egg freezing if those numbers were found to be lower? So I guess it's, even if we found that egg numbers had declined or you had a lower ovarian reserve, our first port of call would be to try and conceive naturally, because those tests are never a predictor of pregnancy as such. They just give us an idea in a fertility clinic of timeline, whether you should delay treatment, whether we should kind of expedite treatment, and then in kind of more detail they give us an idea of dosing in terms of treatments. But it's not a predictor of pregnancy, is the first thing to say. It's okay. Just more of a timeline.
And are you finding that more and more people are they're wanting to get professional advice before they even come up against an issue, just to know where they stand with their chance of conceiving? Because of these things, like you say, like wanting to wait for X, Y, and Z, or wanting to, you know, travel, or maybe they haven't met someone yet. Do you find that people are taking that initiative? And do you advise, do you think that's good that people do that?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I do and I don't. I mean, like, I you know, sometimes you see clinics being offering ovarian reserve testing for free to young girls. And like I say, it's in isolation, it's not the most valuable of tests, and it can cause a lot of stress and strain, you know, on women who aren't trying to conceive yet. So I think if you have something going on that you knew that you've always had a problem with your periods or they're irregular and you're now starting to try to conceive, then I think an early kind of fertility review is reasonable, even if it's just to say, actually, things look really good. Yeah. I think it's reasonable for you guys to continue trying to conceive for 6 to 12 months and come back to us then. Or if you're a little bit older and you consider egg freezing, or consider donor sperm IVF on your own, then or donor sperm treatment on your own, then it's also valuable. And we certainly see people kind of being a bit more proactive about it now, and certainly couples where the female partner is a little bit older, people are being more proactive than waiting maybe the kind of 1 to 2 years of trying.
Yeah, because for me, you know, I was very lucky. We got pregnant on, I think it was our second month of trying, and I know that's not an indicator of how, like, that's not necessarily, I don't know, if is it common that would happen? And maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, it's great. I mean, the younger you are, the more likely it is to happen. Do you know that? Yeah. It's just the way it is.
So I was 31.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I feel like for myself that, like, even though, you know, you say it can be 6 to 12 months and there doesn't need to be anything wrong and that could be perfectly normal to not get pregnant for 12 months, I still think that after about 5 to 6 months, I would feel like I want to just go in and know where what I'm dealing with and where I stand, because it's very hard. You can't not start to think, what if something's wrong? And then if you know, even if there isn't something wrong, with that stress starts to affect you and play in your mind. So I suppose, you know, we the option is there for people to go and I guess have a checkup, really, isn't it? With a clinic like yourselves.
And I'd be kind of the same as you. And even if it is just reassurance, that we found nothing and you can continue to try and everything looks really healthy, I think that'd be really valuable, because then it takes some of the stress out of your mind. Whereas if something shows up, then you know that you're trying and you know what you want a family. So then the options are there for you then.
Absolutely, it
has shown up. So I think, I'd be proactive as well.
If a couple comes to you, let's just say it's there's two people involved, they're not sure if there being any issue, they're not aware of any underlying conditions, the woman has not been diagnosed with PCOS or anything, but it's just they're thinking, oh, we feel like it should have happened by now. What's the kind of traditional, where do you start with that person, or what can they expect in terms of, like, do you start with like a consultation and then do you do scans, and is it divided between both male and female? And just to give people an idea.
Yeah. So it's really important to, I guess, like I said, meet the couple first. Some people have investigations beforehand and it's just what they would rather. Some people don't want any investigations and just want the consultation part, which is absolutely fine as well. I think it's helpful to have the investigations done, because then you kind of have a more informed discussion. And obviously what you're talking about, you know, history is really important. Have they had any, you know, surgeries in the past? Has the male had any injuries to the testes or undescended testes as a child, or surgery for hernias on the groin? Have either of the couple had STIs? You know, all of those things which might kind of indicate that certain investigations that should be done. And then in terms of our basic investigations for the female, we tend to do, based on her cycle, an ultrasound at the first half of the cycle. So anywhere between day 2 and day 8, and that gives us an idea of the smaller follicles that are there at the start of a cycle before one of the follicles becomes the dominant follicle and then releases the egg. And other things it looks for is maybe ovarian cysts that you didn't know about or did know about, looking for signs of endometriosis, which is a condition that can impact on fertility, looking for fibroids or the structure of the womb, and does that look normal? But that's all kind of less common. And then the male partner should also do a semen analysis, and that involves either coming to a clinic or at home producing a sample and that being assessed for different semen parameters, such as, is the sperm moving well? Are the number of sperm normal? And does the sperm look normal under microscope? So it's really important to have both factors, you know, because probably, you know, I used to read about like a third, a third, a third. So third male factor, a third female factor, and a third kind of combined factor. It's probably not quite that, but roughly, do you know?
But that's good to know, because I think women feel that it's very much, even the narrative around fertility is around women and women feeling like it's their fault or it's a problem with them. But to know that it's, even if it's close to a third, a third, a third, is helpful to know, because I think we tend to focus so much on, like, well, what's wrong with me? Whereas, you know, it's important, like, I feel like if you're going to go down the route of having yourself checked out and there's two of you in it, to go with just having the woman be scanned and everything, you could be driving yourself mad and there's nothing wrong, but it's actually the sperm or something. So it's like, it's so important for both people to present to you.
Yeah. And like I said, with the male factor side of things, sometimes it can be just lifestyle changes that can change semen analysis around, you know, entirely. So it is certainly you'd need both partners to be investigated, and I know that can be sometimes difficult to convince people to be investigated, but it's vital if you want the whole picture. Yeah
absolutely. And okay, so I guess, I mean, it's not like you go in on day one and you're signed up for IVF on day two. Is IVF typically like the last resort?
Well, it depends again. So like we spoke about, like you're trying to, I guess, get an assessment in terms of, can we identify anything at all? Because, you know, you probably will have a cohort of people that will fall into this really frustrating bracket of unexplained, and whereas it doesn't mean that nothing's wrong, it just means that we can't identify it. So, you know, if we can find something that's identifiable, like the PCOS and then not ovulating, then the treatment pathway changes, because that is, you know, that is something we can do to bring about ovulation, and then you're back down to the normal population chances of getting pregnant. And the next kind of, in terms of invasive treatments and cost, next treatment that we talk about would be something called IUI, which is intrauterine insemination. So that's essentially where we wash a sample of the male partner's sperm and then take control of a woman's ovulatory cycle and inject the sperm into the woman around the time that they're ovulating. So we trigger them to ovulate and then 36 hours later do the IUI process. But again, there's prerequisites to that. So that's really just a very enhanced version of sex. So if you're having sex at home and it's you know, there's nothing wrong there, then we're just kind of optimizing the environment for that in IVF. So we do need to make sure that the female partner's tubes are open for something like that, because obviously we're not taking anything outside the body and putting it in terms of the woman. So the egg still has to come down the tube, and the sperm has to travel to the right place. So the sperm has to be moving well, the tubes have to be open, and you have to be ovulating for that treatment to be even considered, you know. And then you move towards your more invasive treatments, such as IVF, as you said.
And can you just give me a little explainer on exactly what IVF is and how it happens?
Yeah. So, as I was saying there, when we scan a woman at the start of a cycle, we might see a number of small follicles on the scan, and we can't see eggs. Eggs are microscopic, but what we can see are these small little follicles or cysts. And sometimes when I use numbers, they're a little bit arbitrary, but say there's six follicles on either side, which would be a healthy number. Mm-hmm. In one cycle, you will release one egg naturally, but they were all the potential eggs that you could have released. So what we try and do with IVF is override your natural hormone and make those follicles, well, make as many of them as we can contain a mature egg during that cycle. So where one will only become big and contain a mature egg in a natural cycle, we give you extra hormone to try and get as many of those follicles as we can contain a mature egg. So while it might take you 10 months to release 10 eggs in a cycle of IVF, you could collect 10 eggs. And it's not that we're going through your eggs any quicker. We're just collecting the ones that might have died off that cycle. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely hard to wrap my head around, but you explain it very well. Would IVF be more common after a certain age?
So it probably is. Probably IUI is more successful in younger couples, and they also have more time, depending on an ovarian reserve, to try the less invasive treatments that maybe have slightly lower success rates. IVF, okay, because it's collecting up a certain number of eggs and mixing them with the sperm and making embryos, it has higher success rates. You know, it's more invasive, it's probably more expensive, but the success rates are higher for sure.
Can you give me an idea of cost? I suppose before someone goes down the route of whether it's going to be simple lifestyle changes or whether there's scans or whether it's IUI or IVF, I know a woman who had a documentary made called Million Dollar Baby, and she told me she spent 50 grand on IVF to get into the point of being pregnant with her baby girl. So is it like a set price per round, or just so people can expect, just to be really transparent about it?
Yeah, I'm trying to think now. So probably, you know, like obviously by the time, you know, paying for consultation and investigations, obviously they add up as well. But I think a cycle of IUI probably comes to nearly €1,000, nearly, you know, it would be under that, I imagine, but all in with to get to that point. And then a cycle of IVF is probably closer to €5,000.
Okay. And how many cycles would you do of both?
So we aim to get a pregnancy with the cycle, obviously, and an ideal cycle where you get a pregnancy and maybe an embryo frozen for future use. So if someone can get away with having all their pregnancies with one cycle, that would be ideal, you know?
Yeah.
Certainly we'd expect you to need more than one cycle of IUI to maybe achieve your pregnancy, you know? Because IUI, again, is just like you're releasing one egg, mixing the sperm with that. So it's more like your natural conception. Whereas with IVF, you're trying to create excess or multiple embryos from one cycle.
And is there a number of IUI cycles that you would do before you would move on to IVF?
It's always up to the, you know, it's up to the patient if they kind of decide they want the more effective treatments first, or they're willing to jump a step, then they can jump straight to IVF. But we'd say up to three to six cycles of IUI is reasonable. But again, people can find that long and frustrating, you know, so, yeah. You know, having a bleed after a cycle is really disappointing and not being pregnant. So it's up to yourself. Some people are willing to try a few cycles and they decide to change halfway through, and you're never tied into anything, do you know?
Yeah.
Certainly I often end up advising IVF because how much more effective it is and the higher success rates. And with the cycle of IUI, you can actually end up taking very similar injections to what you end up taking for IVF, but just a much lower dose. Okay. So for the woman, it's not hugely different. Do you know? It can be equally as long and difficult.
Is there like a maximum number of cycles of IVF that you would advise someone do before you'd say, look, we can't put your body through this anymore?
Oh God, that's probably a difficult question to ask. I mean, if not, okay. But I don't think it'd be fair to let someone kind of indefinitely continue IVF, but we try and titrate things to every cycle. If you do need a second cycle to change something, to change a medication, to change a dose, you know, try optimize the quality of the embryos that we're making, you know, and we learn more every cycle is the other thing to say.
Yeah, you get more data each time. And do you have any idea of the statistics around the IVF success rates?
Yeah, so our own success rates are really good at the moment. So we on our website, we have ones from 2017, and I was looking at them the other day, and it's probably a live birth rate, which is the ultimate, because obviously you'll get pregnancy tests that are positive and then they'll end up in biochemical pregnancies or miscarriages, but the live birth rate, so take home baby rate, I guess you got, is probably around 35% per cycle for women who are 35. Wow. And it does drop down then after the age of kind of say 42, which would be more so like a 10% per cycle, do you know? So okay. It does drop down quite significantly.
But this is, you know, this is assuming you have to even go and get this help and go and have these either non-invasive or slightly more invasive treatments. But there's an awful lot we can do before we get to that point, or even alongside that. I mean, you know, like you say, you could be doing IVF and alongside that you could be doing lifestyle changes that will really be the thing that makes a difference. So what can we do naturally to increase the chance of being pregnant? And from both the female and the male perspective?
So women who are trying to get pregnant should be on folic acid for kind of 3 months pre-pregnancy. And that's just to reduce the incidence of neural tube defects like spina bifida. So that should be something, you can do that'll just help your chances of having a very normal pregnancy. Not smoking is really important. Reducing alcohol intake, we would advise 1 to 2 units of alcohol 1 to 2 times a week for women, which doesn't seem like a lot, I know, but it's all about optimizing, you know, your natural chances. Your BMI being in the healthy range is a really important one.
Okay, so being like, you don't want to be going on too much of like a weight loss mission while you're trying to conceive.
Exactly, yeah. And sometimes women's periods stop once they become too light or or the BMI is too low. And the same way, if the BMI is too high, you know, sometimes the periods disappear as well. So we kind of aim for BMI between 19 and 30. And I know that's a little bit arbitrary as well, but that's what international guidelines would suggest.
Okay.
And being aware of your own period and trying to optimize when you're having sex. So the fertile window, so the lead up to when you ovulate. And then for men, Again, you know, not smoking cannabis, not taking any kind of steroid supplements that you might see men who gym a lot taking. Lots and lots of cycling can increase the heat to the scrotum, so that can sometimes impact on sperm quality.
In a negative way?
In a negative way, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's obviously really good to exercise. It's just the type of exercise that you might do. A laptop on your lap or being sedentary. So like if your job is driving all the time, you know, just being aware of that.
Yeah.
And then the supplements that you can take, you know, over the counter that you'd see in a pharmacy, they can help improve sperm quality. And it's similar to the way we take them, you know, your folic acid and your vitamin D. There's some similar ones that men can take as well, which probably isn't highlighted as much, do you know?
Yeah. And how important is like balanced nutrition? You know, it's not just, obviously the BMI is super important, but you could achieve a certain BMI with not very nutritionally dense food. So like in my head, I suppose, I just feel like when you want to conceive, your body needs to be in like sort of homeostasis balance and not feel under threat in any way. So not like trying to, oh, we have to send in the troops and fight off this other thing that we're trying to deal with, such as, oh, we've just lost too much weight too quickly, or that kind of thing. And especially for, you know, even like for me, like my other podcast is all around anxiety and stuff. And I remember talking to my doctor when my anxiety was so bad, and I said, oh God, how will I ever cope being pregnant? And she just said, well, actually, by the time you get pregnant, in order to get pregnant, you'll probably be quite a balanced state hormonally for it to even happen in the first place.
Yeah, and I think balance is the key word there. You know, I think couples who are maybe having difficulty trying to conceive can become really transfixed and on doing everything right, cut out everything, you know, and that's not the best way to live either. You know, like people who entirely cut out, say, caffeine, where they've loved a cup of coffee in the mornings, or chocolate, or, you know, like it's all about balance and just being healthy, enjoying, you know, having a really good mental health, a really good relationship, you know. So it's you know, I won't lecture on nutrition as such, because I'm not, you know, an expert in that area at all, but it's just about having balance and kind of in moderation and, like you said, getting all your proper nutrients, you know, because you will get a lot of what we, you know, what you'll see in supplements in normal foods. And I think nutritionists would always say that if you can get it in a food that's, you know, natural rather than having to supplement it, that would be ideal. Do you know? And most of them, you know, like a supplement will never replace what you can get in a vegetable or,
exactly,
you know, in fruits, you know. So that,
yeah. And I want to ask you about stress. So I think obviously like we're increasingly aware of the impact that stress can have on health in so many different ways. But when a couple are trying, or a woman is trying to conceive and it's not happening, it's so hard not to get stressed. And then you're stressed out about the fact that you're stressed because, you know, stress is going to impact getting pregnant. How do you advise people manage that? Because it, of course, it's stressful.
Yeah. And I think that is important to acknowledge. First of all, this is stressful. You know, there's no two ways about it. Do you know, like we're, you know, the medication part of it is stressful, the having sex, time sex is stressful. So
financial stress, even.
Yeah, financial stress, 100%. And suddenly everyone around you is pregnant is the other thing to say, yeah. You know, and your friends are all getting pregnant without even trying, you know, so that certainly enhances the stress. But, you know, I remember my consultant saying to me before that I think it's more infertility causes stress rather than stress causes infertility. So you can be aware of it. It's not, you know, like you said, it's not something that is going to hopefully impact on your treatment, but it's certainly probably something that goes in hand with your treatment. And we can't get rid of it entirely. There's certainly some, you know, therapies that can help with it. I know a lot of women find acupuncture and things like that helpful, or mindfulness or something that can kind of try and combat that for you. But it is inherently a stressful time for couples, you know, so it is really hard to eliminate that entirely.
Well, for me, I mean, when it comes to stress or anxiety in any way that you'd have it in any guise in life, it's not about getting rid of it, but saying, okay, well, I understand why this is, it makes sense, and I need to like accept this. And I think even just that change of perspective on it, like, of course you're stressed out if you're trying to get pregnant, it's not happening, and you're trying to save money, and, you know, so it's not about trying to feel totally relaxed about it, but saying it's okay that I feel that way. And even that mindset shift alone will have an impact on the hormones in your body, like the stress hormones in your body.
Absolutely. And that's a really, really good way of putting it. And it's not something that's going to happen overnight. That's obviously something that you've learned or you've kind of thought about for a while. But you're so right. It's not trying to hide it under the carpet and pretending that it's not stressful, because it is. And it's embracing that and just dealing, you know, learning to deal with that, or kind of make it a little bit less of a factor in your day-to-day life. Yeah.
Yeah. And is there anything else that people need to be aware of that maybe is not so widely known or discussed when it comes to trying for a baby? Like any really simple things that you might forget?
I hate to say, I think female age is the big one. You know, I think we are an aging society and we're putting it off. You know, family is you know, happening later. We're all kind of striving to be the best that we can be in terms of jobs, financial security, wanting a house, and we want all these things before we start trying. And I think, you know, there's never a good time or the perfect time to get pregnant is the other thing that I've often been told. And if you're thinking about it, think about it sooner rather than later is kind of...
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, when myself and my husband started having the conversation, it was like, we're having a great time, you know, we're going traveling, we've got our house, like we could happily do this for another 5 years. We don't necessarily feel the need or want to have a child right now, but we know that we want to have one at some point, or we reckon we will want to. So for us, it was just like, well, rather than wait until we might have an issue, let's risk it happening sooner than we really ready for. And then that's what happened. And of course, I mean, that still had an adjustment, because we were like, okay, well, now all the plans are off the table. You know, so it is a case, you're never ready, and you're never ready for pregnancy. And I'm not ready for labor or anything now that even that I'm here, even though I'm here and even though it's what I wanted, you know. And I'd love to just ask you, but before we wrap up, so something that, you know, is becoming more and more common is women who, like you say, are getting a bit older, maybe haven't met someone, or maybe don't want to, or maybe they're in a female relationship, and they want to know what their options are for having a baby.
But as it becomes more common, we have so much more expertise in the area. So a few years ago, some tech companies offered to, you know, egg freezing for their female workers, and that's probably what started highlighted, was it wrong, was it right? But actually that kind of opened the conversation for lots of people, and I've certainly lots of friends who are now considering it, but for different reasons. They don't want a pregnancy at the moment, or they're not in the, you know, they don't have a relationship or whatever. It's a really good option. And we would, you know, unfortunately for a cycle of egg freezing, you do have to do a cycle of IVF to get to that point. But it's a really good backup plan. It's a really good insurance policy, you know, that you might use down the line. If you did suddenly meet Mr. Right, or you decided that you were going to use donor sperm or whatever it is, you don't, like, if you met someone, we wouldn't say use your frozen egg straight away. We'd obviously advise try to conceive yourself. But if you don't, then you know that you have those eggs frozen in time whenever you froze them, say 34-year-old eggs or 33-year-old eggs frozen in time, and they don't age. So that's why I think it's valuable. It takes pressure off people then, if they're in a new relationship, not to have to have the conversation about pregnancy straight away. Yeah. So that's a really great option for women who either want to do it on their own, or want to kind of save their eggs for the future. For women in a relationship with women, then there's the option, as you said, of donor sperm. And it kind of changed in legislation in Ireland since May this year. So there's a few changes in legislation. You have to undergo treatment in Ireland. It's identifiable sperm donors. So we don't use anonymous sperm donors anymore here. So essentially, you go online to you register for your sperm donor site, and we use kind of in Ireland, we use kind of the European Sperm Bank, or another one called Cryos, and there's a little like you can filter it out so that you can pick the ones that the donors that have signed that they're happy to use in Ireland. And that's kind of just to protect the intended parents. So, you know, they signed consent for parentage, and then the donor signs up his right for parentage. So it's a good thing. It's just that legislation has changed recently, you know, and couples do need to be aware of that.
And if people want to maybe come in for consultation, maybe they're not aware of anything yet, maybe there is a problem or maybe there isn't, your doors are always open for that initial consultation chat, is that right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's I think it's really easy now because of the Zoom. You know, you could be at home, or you know, working from home, or you know, just in your you know, just online, and it's very easy now, you know, and you can get your few investigations done, and it can be just a reassuring consultation just to check that everything is in order and that you're good to go. Or if, like you said, if it's 6 months into it and that can either buy you time or kind of optimize your what you're doing at home yourselves, you know.
Amazing. And you guys have lots of information for, like, if people want to drill down on your website.
Exactly. Loads online, yeah. And it's all very accessible there. And, you know, you can just refer yourselves as well, which is also helpful. You don't have to have a GP to refer in. This is online self-referral.
Okay,
which
great.
Some women find more accessible as well, rather than going to the GP and looking for a referral that way.
Amazing. Okay. Dr. Maeve Horne, I should say, thank you so, so much for your time. I've completely just annihilated you with question after question there, and thank you for answering everything so well. I hope we've covered everything. You being the expert, reckon we have touched on a lot of the important stuff at least.
Yeah, it's been really enjoyable.
You probably need to have a lie down now after all of that. But thank you so much, and I'm
good luck with your own pregnancy. I'm excited for you.
Thank you. And I'm really hopeful now that this episode will give women and men a bit of encouragement and confidence and make them feel more empowered as they hopefully begin their journey.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.